A year ago, I released an episode of The Luke Alfred Show about my experiences as a schoolboy in the 1970s in Johannesburg, South Africa, and how I fell in love with sport. This is a follow-up to that episode. Come and join me for stories about the Wanderers Cricket Ground, Ajax Amsterdam, and the legendary sports broadcaster Charles Fortune. Welcome to The Luke Alfred Show. I have 30 years of experience on the front lines of sports journalism, covering some of the biggest games in cricket, rugby, the FIFA World Cup, and even the Olympic Games. Come and join me as we learn about some of the greatest sports stories you've never heard. I'm Luke Alfred, and welcome to the show. One of the joys of growing up in Africa is walking around barefoot. You can walk and run on the grass, walk on the pavement, walk on that strange 1970s surface, slasto, a slate-like substance which often surrounded suburban swimming pools. There was nothing finer, more blissfully elemental, than walking barefoot across a wooden floor. I am knock-kneed. When I was growing up, my knock-knees needed remedial action, so I was carted off to a gruff German physiotherapist in Parktown, Johannesburg. Her house was tree-encircled, therefore free of sunshine, therefore cold, which seemed somehow to magnify her coldness. She had me pick up marbles with my toes and walk across the linoleum floor with my toes clenched. I did strengthening exercises to raise my collapsed arches. Orthopedic supports, they looked a little like old-fashioned shoehorns, were inserted into my shoes to bring my splendid knock knees into acceptable alignment. Given these supports, which were uncomfortable and demeaning, I took off my shoes and sand shoes, called tackies in South Africa, at every available opportunity. Walking on grass at home and school and at friends' houses was an easy pleasure, but the feeling of feelings was to walk on the outfield of the Wanderers Cricket Stadium in bare feet. The outfield was a carpet of lush, magnificent green. It was so spongy that it almost embalmed your foot. These were the days of heaven. As primary schoolboys, we used to go to the Wanderers on Corlett Drive to watch four-day matches on Friday or Monday afternoons, often getting into the ground for a nominal sum or sometimes for free. The pocket money we saved by not paying entrance fee was spent guzzling Mars pies, sometimes chicken and mushroom, sometimes steak and kidney. They came in little tinfoil trays. You needed to eat most of the pie before you found the single piece of chicken or steak meant to give them their flavor. At least there was cool drink in a range of radioactive colors to wash them down with. The food was revolting, but delectable too. Watching the cricket we'd come for was almost an afterthought because it meant being still, which was difficult for all of us. I did see Graham Pollock, true, and Steve Jeffries with his high leg and whippy cartwheel action. Alan Curry was slow and dependable, like a water wheel. He batted without backlift and without flourish, as if he was struggling to stay awake. His preferred bat was the Duncan Fernley. Kevin McKenzie, Neil's father, sans helmet, only a cap, was pathologically busy. Jimmy Cook fiddled with the top of his pad when batting because he imagined it needed to be adjusted. Henry Fotheringham had a kind of cheeky, smiling neatness that was a form of subtle assertion. I think Pollock rested his bat on his shoulder, giving him a martial air. It was heavy and dangerous, like a broadsword. In a quieter, less obvious way, he was as intimidating as Viv Richards. He must have been hell to bowl to. Alvin Kalicharan, the West Indian, who stayed on after the West Indian rebels had departed, took small steps. He had fine, quick hands. Hugh Page had a lazy approach to the crease, almost an afterthought, but was quicker than his run-up suggested he should be. I remember the late Mike Proctor barreling in from over the horizon like the arrival of the slightly dishevelled cavalry. Sylvester Clark, the West Indian, was all chest. he trundled in almost comically until one of his off-cutters sliced you in half. Such heroes were the backdrop to our scratch games at lunch or tea time, when we'd flood onto the field for 20 minutes or half an hour so we could be heroes too. Someone always brought along a plank that had been whittled into a homemade bat. The handle was often covered in red, yellow, or black masking tape. Sometimes you had your own bat, which you may or may not have been reluctant to share. Matches were of the electric wicket and one-hand, one-bounce variety. We played with tennis balls, occasionally weighed down with tape on one side. At lunchtime, it was pandemonium on the outfield because hundreds of boys, and some fathers, were all doing exactly the same thing. There were matches everywhere. In the mayhem, amidst the shouting and confusion of many overlapping games on the field, it was possible to lose your ball or have it stolen, particularly if it was hit far and you weren't quite sure of where it had landed. The complexion of these lunchtime pickup games was changed by the clanging of the five-minute bell, a kind of pre-death death knell. When the bell tolled, you knew that you needed to start wrapping it up, because soon the players would be coming down the stairs from the dressing room alongside the edge of the grass embankment. I can hear the clatter of their spikes on the tar still. Unfortunately, you couldn't walk barefoot across the Wanderers' outfield all day. Sometimes you needed to put on your slops or sandals or shoes and come indoors. Parents were distant planets, only hoving into view now and again, before continuing on their slow, preoccupied orbit. There was no TV and sisters didn't play cricket. Friends weren't always available, so you needed to make a plan. I must have been about 9 years old when I went through an obsessive bout of pencil drawing. I was fascinated at the time. I'm guessing this was 1973, with Ajax Amsterdam, the most successful football club in Europe at the time. What really fascinated me about them was not their glamour nor their conspicuous success, but how they looked. I was 9 and hopelessly shallow. It mattered how things looked. I'd never seen a thick vertical stripe down a shirt front before. Yes, I had seen horizontal stripes and hoops. I'd even seen thin vertical stripes. But I'd never before seen an assertively thick red stripe, somehow made more suggestive because it was cast against a pristine white backdrop. So, this was Ajax. They came from Amsterdam. The world was a far bigger place in those days, and Johannesburg was far away from everything, except Pretoria. Ajax Amsterdam were in Europe, on the other side of the equator. They were thrillingly exotic. Amsterdam was a liberal city whose progressive bent shaded into carefree Dutch promiscuity, but they weren't so promiscuous that their club didn't know how to win at football, which they played with a flourish as unmistakable as the red stripe on their shirts. My pencil drawings were little comic or storybooks. They told the story of European Cup runs gleaned from other sources, magazines and books. I was 9 years old and hadn't learnt the art of dynamic movement, which meant that the drawings had an immobile, frozen feel, but this didn't feel important to me at the time. What was important was that my pencil drawings, each with a little accompanying caption beneath, was a launch pad for my imagination, which was fervent and busy. Through this portal, I stepped into another world. Youth, for many of us, is a time of invented worlds, particularly if we are lonely or quietly self-sufficient or slightly interned children. I was a gregarious, free-spirited child, often curious and in search of things I couldn't name. I was also introverted, happy to make a nest somewhere and read Rider Haggard's She and King Solomon's Mines and John Buchan's The 39 Steps, featuring Richard Hannay, Buchan's upstanding hero. Such books were housed in a bookroom on the first floor of H.A. Jack Primary School in Highlands North, where I went to school. It was a room into which I was occasionally allowed, either because I was a monitor or a prefect, or perhaps because I had some feel for the job in need of doing. This meant bringing 30 or so hardback copies of H. Rider Haggard's novel into class for distribution, although maybe I was allowed special dispensation to read by myself. The book room was dark and airless, with the books themselves arranged on Meccano-like shelves. They were nominally hardback, but the backing was soft. The books had a subtle, almost delicate smell, part pulp, part ink, part dust and stale air. So began the soulfully lost, uncounted days. They slipped away like mine dump dust on a September wind. Forgive me while I interrupt a sports story to tell you about the Luke Alfred Show Patreon. As you may know, being a writer is not the most lucrative career choice. Please consider making a small donation to keep the show going at patreon.com/theLukeAlfredShow. But for now, let's get back to the story. Class Readers by John Buchan or Rider Haggard represented the literary high bar. Below that were more plebeian tastes, Wilbur Smith and Louis L'Amour, the Hardy Boys, Frank and Joe Hardy, and their friend and my favourite, Chet Morton. I owned a freestanding pine bookcase, the shelves staggered in such a way that the top shelf was narrower than the shelf beneath. This, in turn, wasn't as wide as the shelf beneath that. There were three or four shelves in all, as I remember. My Hardy Boys hardcover collection was pridefully arranged on the top two shelves. Each book came in a different, brightly coloured spine. I was proud of the books well into my early adolescence until, again I'm guessing, it was pointed out that Frank, Joe and Chet were a little too primary school for any self-respecting high schooler. We were now all wearing long trousers, no longer boys, yet to be men. It was time to say goodbye to fictional Bayport, the backdrop to their happy ending adventures. In my pencil drawings, I discovered the Ajax players, Johan Cruyff, Ruud Krol, Arie Haan, Johan Neeskens, Piet Keizer, their captain. My favourite player, though, was called Johnny Rep. It must have been the unusual name, Rep, rather than any deep-seated appreciation of his football talent, which was significant. A winger with naughty eyes, Rep twinkled. It was unmistakable. I saw it, even aged 9. I was thrilled to find out many years later that after his time at Ajax, Rep had been transferred to Bastia, the Corsican club, who played in the French league. It was an unusual career move, to say the least. Although one vindicated, when Bastia reached the final of the UEFA Cup in 1978, where they were convincingly beaten by PSV Eindhoven 3-0. Names and colours did it for me, nicknames maybe, not deeds or achievements. My identification was that of a child's, basic, because I was seeing life for the very first time. Closer to home, there were nicknames, particularly for the cricketers I watched at the Wanderers whenever I could, sitting on the eastern stands close to the old scoreboard from where we casually flicked bottle tops onto the heads of passers-by down below. Spook Hanley and his mop of ghost-like blonde hair, Dopey Duval, Dussie Biggs, nicknamed because of two prominent rock-rabbit-like front teeth, and let's not forget Anton Yogi Ferreira, the burly Northerns and Warwickshire all-rounder, who is said to resemble the cartoon character Yogi Bear. Sometimes there were abbreviations or foreshortenings. Fotheringham, he of the lazy cover drive, was called Fothers. Clive Rice became, of course, Ricey. Rice was forever in combat with his perpetually unravelling long sleeves. He liked his sleeves folded at the elbow, but in his long run to the crease, the sleeve always unravelled. It took his walk to the top of his mark to roll it up again, and now, at the ready, he charged in with purpose before rocking back, cradle-like, in that characteristic rice-like motion prior to delivery. His bowling action, he wasn't a big man, was biomechanically perfect and aggressive, as he was. Even as a boy in the stands, you sensed Rice's snarl. Vincent van der Bijl was plain old Vince, or sometimes Big Vince. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, Vince was a medium-fast bowler not to be trifled with. His mastery of length was such that there was no disconnect, or there seemed to be no disconnect, between what he wanted to do and what he did. He was mostly bald and very tall and wide, with tufts of hair fluttering about the ears. He wore a baggy pullover and trundled, almost mincing, to the crease on big boots, somehow caterpillar-like, because his run-up was made of an infinity of small steps. He never broke into a stride, never seemed to gather any pace, so it was difficult to explain how he did what he did. It came about from what seemed like an eternal loping, a kind of rolling to the crease that gained momentum and critical mass the longer it lasted. Van der Bijl was the antithesis of athleticism. Still, with his height-generating bounce, he got the ball, magic word coming up, to nibble. He was chillingly effective. Charles Fortune, radio commentator and doyen of the microphone, was there to pronounce upon it all. He pronounced Van der Bijl the way the English do, with a crisp A sound rather than the flatter U sound. Charles was always mildly critical of the time it took Van der Bijl to bowl an over. He was often mildly critical of what he saw as disrespect to the English language, engaging in a long joust with the phrasing and grammar of items on the radio news. Charles would have used the verb nibble with undisguised relish. Charles made his way to South Africa from England in the mid-1930s and became a schoolmaster and science teacher at St. Andrew's College in Grahamstown, or Makunda as it is now called. Later, he became the voice of cricket on the South African Broadcasting Corporation's English service, and we'll include a snippet or two of his commentary for you here, just so you can enjoy it or relive it, if you're already familiar with his voice. In it, he speaks about a whippet wandering onto the Wanderers during a Currie Cup game in the early 1980s, and the whippet being led back across the boundary ropes by Big Vince. It is vintage Fortune, wistful and tolerantly amused, always on the lookout for something interesting or unusual.
A whippet has gone onto the playing field. Van der Bijl is only too delighted not to have to get on with the bowling. He's going to see this whippet right away to the boundary rope. It's on his way back, of course, down to the his own bowling mark. But I cannot imagine an occasion that could give Van der Bijl greater delight than to have a pal who enables him to take more time in getting down to bowl his over. Now, Van der Bijl hoists the whippet up, places it behind the fence. The three people in the grandstand give him a hearty round of applause, just why I don't know. And so the kennel man is now about to become the fast bowler with the new cherry. All the time the cricket period is slipping away and Transvaal's bowling rate is becoming the less presentable as a result of the slight interruption in which it was Van der Bijl and the whippet.
Fortune spoke the language with feeling and emotion, but he wasn't above a flurry of verbal showboating. He loved to describe the gathering cumulus clouds and the swim of the breeze through the blue gums at the back of the wooden wanderer's stands. He was attentive to the natural world, he said, because he wanted cricket to be inclusive. By describing the natural world, he argued, he encouraged housewives to better know the game. For many white South Africans of a certain generation, he was the soundtrack of summer, the aural backdrop against which we lived our strangely complacent sleepwalking lives. In his book on his one and only test for the Springboks against the British Lions at Loftus-Versfeld in 1974, Dugald MacDonald, the Springbok eighth man, wrote that Gerard Verbeers, the Afrikaans radio commentator, quote, invented Springbok rugby. The phrase has stayed with me because, while not objectively true, it is figuratively accurate and perceptively wise. What Dugald means is that Verbeers conjured Springbok rugby into being by creating a new vocabulary for it. In so doing, he gave it life. Fortune did something similar for cricket. He unconsciously used cricket as a vehicle for offering us a vision of the world. In these narrow terms, he was a consummate artist. Sometimes Fortune's vocabulary amounted to nothing more than adjusting things. For example, Charles didn't like the idea of the Transvaal opener being called Jimmy Cook. James Cook was more regal than Jimmy, so Charles simply called Cook James, as in the captain in the South Pacific. Eddie Barlow, which as a name was good enough for most of us, wasn't good enough for the class-conscious Charles, so he called Eddie Barlow Edgar John, as though Eddie was an overgrown schoolboy or one of Robin Hood's merry band. In this way, Fortune minted his rhetorical fortune. Charles was world-creating, and he created the world, in some small part, in his image, with his bias, with his desire. If, as a schoolboy growing up in Johannesburg in the late 1970s and early 1980s, you didn't have at least a possible Charles Fortune impersonation at your disposal, you were a lost soul, forced to wander in the social wilderness. The corridors of my high school in Highlands North were full of Fortune impersonators. It is difficult to convey to younger generations just how influential he was and how loved. If the times can be said to be condensed into a voice, say in the way that we associate Winston Churchill's voice with the Second World War, or Nelson Mandela's voice with the transition to South African democracy, Fortune's voice was the voice of English-speaking white South Africa in a moment of cultural defensiveness. By turns he was vigilant, gently egotistical, amusing, and slightly pompous. We might even go so far as to say that he invented isolation, and that he gave the period in which South African cricket was banished from world cricket shape and colour and form. He gave it characters, which he renamed. They played on a green stage, and he invented them all. Fortune might have wanted cricket and his commentary to reach deep into the world, but his world was an exclusive one. It was a world slow to change. I shuddered to think what he would have made of T20 cricket or the 100. Listening to Fortune now, I'm struck by how frozen the world he described was, how frozen and how self-referring, and finally how sad because it has become a museum piece. For all our contemporary anxieties and election fears, here in South Africa, we are better off now, facing the future with open eyes. This is not, needless to say, how we experienced Fortune's commentary when I was growing up and falling in love with sport in a variety of imaginative ways. I remember Monday afternoons in summer, when we weren't at the cricket, being picked up by Betty Slay, classmates Wendy's mother, listening to Charles on the car radio. Betty drove a mini into which the three or four of us in the lift scheme squeezed. We listened and discussed the game he was commentating about. Fortune's commentary worked like a charm. He made our carefully constructed world, a world that fell apart in 1976 with the riots in Soweto, stable and reassuring. Sport itself was stable and reassuring, even if the sporting boycott meant that increasingly white South Africans played only amongst themselves. Maybe this accounts for why white South Africans are so crazily competitive. They had to be, for their very lives depended upon their zeal and appetite for a fight. This world, however, rested on wobbly foundations, so couldn't be stable and reassuring forever. Today, it is a lost world, available in glimpses on Facebook, and snippets in black and white elsewhere. We refer to it as we would to a guilty pleasure, for that, finally, is what nostalgia is. If you enjoyed this episode of The Luke Alfred Show, please give me a 5-star rating. As an independent creator, this podcast is made possible through your support